Thank you, Ilya. I wanted to start by thanking the organizers for it's been a very productive and interesting conference for me in a very beautiful place. And I don't have a song, but I want to thank NSF too for the support that I've gotten. I realized when I wrote the title, I forgot to put in SLEs. Part of this work applies to SLEs, as you'll see. There are actually two things I'm going to talk about. The work that I did with Don Zagay that Ilya just mentioned in looking at some modular properties of crossing probabilities, and some more recent work with my student Jake Simmons and Bob Ziff at Michigan. Now, so there's a title which is a little better, but the logic is rather complicated, and maybe one should, with apologies to Vladdy, make a simpler one, something like that. I guess that's where we are, I guess. It's nice to be in a place where the weather is practically like summer in Maine, so at this time of year. So anyway, I'll just briefly describe percolation. I think everybody knows the model, but I'll go through it quickly anyway and tell you what crossing probabilities are, which I think everybody doesn't know. And then the connection to Pott's models, which is used to apply boundary conformal field theory, which again I'll describe in some cursory way, hopefully.
The main points.
Oh, I'm sorry. Unfortunately, I don't have a remote. And then talk about this actually more recent work on anchored clusters and connection probabilities, which I think will look a little more familiar to people, and then go on to the more mathematical things, the modular forms and so on. And I'll do that in two steps. You can apply modular forms to one kind of crossing probability, and then I'll talk about, I'll give you a brief review of SLEs with apologies to the experts, which I'm not. And as I think probably everybody here knows, one of the recent Fields Medals was given to Wendell and Werner for work in that area. And then we'll look at more modular properties. And actually, it turns out that a new kind of modular object arises when you analyze these crossing probabilities. That's been interesting for number theorists in recent years. I'm sorry, I like catchy titles. So I wanted to call this A Tale of Two Symmetries, but really there's a lot of symmetries in here. There's conformal symmetry and percolation, or this is now ordinary percolation at the percolation point in two dimensions, has a triangular symmetry, which it seems to me actually is one of the deepest problems in the subject. Where does that come from? And additionally, we'll see a modular symmetry really as a covariance. And then there's duality, which I think most people here know. I wrote this talk for mathematicians, so if it looks a little simple, it's because it's intended for people who don't know anything about these things, or very little, or most of them don't. Actually, some of them do, but most of them don't. So at any rate, after some introduction, I'll talk about some of these new CFT results on a percolation connection probability that factorizes exactly. And then in the last part, I'll talk about... Something wrong? Yeah. You can read. Yeah, I know. Look out for Maine. I should use the wooden one. The third section is the modular work that I did with Don some years ago. Here's the review of percolation and crossing probabilities. And percolation is deceptively simple, really. In some sense, you would think it was the simplest system in which you can have a phase transition. But that's deceptive, and probably the reason is, and I owe this remark to Andreas from some years ago, that it's unconstrained. When you start looking at it from a deeper point of view, it's really rather complicated. So at any rate, just to be definite, consider bond percolation on a square lattice, which means you put bonds down with probability P between the points of the lattice, and so a given configuration could look like that, and it's the properties of the clusters that are interesting. Their geometric properties. And of course, you can do percolation, you can define the model in many other different ways, on different lattices, different types of site percolation, you can do it even on certain random lattices, and so on. But at the percolation point, which is what we're interested in, all of these problems in the field theory limit have the same description. They can all be described with conformal field theory. Am I standing in the way? Is that... Yeah, sorry. The trouble is I'm reading it in my head. So, you know, as you all know, if this probability of occupying a bond is small, then most of the time you won't have a lot of clusters. And if it's large, then it'll be mostly full. But it's known, in fact, rigorously in 2D that there's always one phase transition, and for this bond model that I showed, it's exactly a 1/2. And at that point, that's the first probability where you actually get an infinite cluster on the lattice, and that's where the interesting properties are, and that's what we're going to look at. And so there'll be a non-zero probability there of going from one side of the lattice to the other, but it's not trivial. It's not always one as it is for P bigger than 1/2. And there's an example cribbed from one of Wendelin's papers of percolation, site percolation in a hexagonal lattice, and is there a left to right crossing on white hexagons? In other words, is there a path from the right edge to the left edge along white hexagons? And actually there is, if you look at that one. Okay, and as I said, in the rest of this talk, I'm going to be looking at PC only and drawing some of the lessons that conformal field theory can give you. And they come mostly via differential equations, which you solve for various physical quantities. Okay, now, to define crossing, I want to consider a large rectangular lattice with aspect ratio R, and with two types of crossing probabilities. One I already mentioned, the horizontal crossing probability is the probability of finding a cluster that connects the left side to the right side, and then the horizontal vertical one is the probability of finding a cluster that connects all four sides. Now, I've written those as a function of R. That's not obvious that they are, but it's now known actually rigorously in both cases. It was originally surmised from computer evidence that I'll talk about a little later, from simulations. And it also comes, if you assume conformal invariance, well, actually, it's consistent with the conformal treatment. I guess it couldn't really, well, never mind. Anyway, it came from the numerical evidence, which was first found by a group headed by Bob Langlands. So it's kind of ironic. I mean, here you have one of the world's most eminent number theorists doing numerical simulations and a theoretical physicist like me doing modular functions, but that's what, that's life.
When you say it depends only on R, what are you varying? I mean, what else?
It could not depend on R, I guess, is really the only other possibility, right? It could just be a constant. It could be 1/2 all the time, for instance, independent of R.
Field theory functions, this could be not invariant, but covariant with transformations.
Well, but then it would have to go away with large R. It would have to go away.
Suppose the boundary changing operators were not, it's dimension zero.
Right.
Depending on the shape of the
dimension. Yeah, but then it would have to be zero, because if it had a finite dimension, it's got to be positive dimension, and then the whole thing goes to zero, right? There's no other possibility, I don't think, because the scaling, the length scale change will give you 1/L to the dimension, right? Yeah. Yeah, I think that's all that can happen.
There would be a statement which one would like to believe in, which is that you could change the microscopic details, change the different lattice or something, and tune to the critical point.
Well, that's true, yeah.
That would be true, maybe that's a much more.
That's right, yeah. You could have a non universal function, that's right. It could depend on the lattice type, but then it wouldn't be conformally invariant in the first place.
It's it's just scaling invariant too much. I guess it depends on R,
just the scaling,
not
the conformal.
So
in the
continuum, if there is a continuum.
Okay.
It could somehow depend as a power, overall power of R in front of it, and that's an additional statement on top of
it. Yeah, that's still a function of R. So it would still be a function of R. Okay. Okay, so it's useful to, in fact, central in this analysis to use duality here. So you can, for the example I showed, you can also write the dual lattice, and then the rule is that if the bond isn't occupied in the original lattice, then it is occupied in the dual lattice, and vice versa, which gives you a diagram like that where hopefully I put in all the lines. And as a result, either there's a horizontal crossing on the lattice, which then blocks the vertical crossing on the dual lattice, or there's no horizontal crossing on the lattice and there is a vertical crossing on the dual lattice, and those are mutually exclusive. And as a result of that, the sum of the two probabilities has to be 1, pi h of r plus pi v of r. But on the other hand, the crossing problem on the dual lattice is exactly the same. In fact, I didn't even put in a label here, as the problem on the original lattice. So pi v of r is pi h of 1 over r, and so you have this equation. Okay. Pi h of r plus pi h of 1 over r equals 1. And now I want to differentiate that with respect to r, and that gives you this. Okay. And if anybody is familiar with modular forms, that's one of the defining equations for a modular form. This is the Targ-Noyton minus 1 over 2 operation, but I'll come back to that later. Now, on the other hand, the horizontal vertical crossing probability, it's much easier just by construction. It has to be invariant when you take r to 1 over r. It doesn't matter which way you draw it, right? You still cross both ways. And so if you differentiate that, you get almost the same equation except with a minus sign. Because now it's on the right-hand side instead of the left-hand side. That minus sign, while it looks rather innocent, actually is the crucial element in this new modular object, as we'll see. Actually, much later, way towards the end of the talk. Okay, now, Potts models. Everybody knows Potts models. I think I won't spend much time on this. These are just generalizations of Ising models. And,
is the change of sign couldn't you get it by complex, going to complexifying the value?
Complexifying the...
R, R, R.
I don't think so. I mean, they're two different quantities, so I don't see how you can... You can't go from one to... They're physically different, so I don't think there's any way to complex. Yeah, and actually, I mean, when we... I didn't actually put it in here, but when we go to the modular bit, I mean, you do complexify R, but the quantity that you get when you complexify R is not a crossing probability anymore. Well, I'm not quite saying that right. Never mind. I'll leave that for now. Anyway, I want to look at the... let me just skip that. I want to look at the Potts models in the Fortuyn-Castellane or random cluster representation, where you sum over all possible configurations of... And you can imagine bond... the percolation configurations of bond percolation on a square lattice like I showed before. So you sum over all possible configurations. There's a parameter P, which I'm sorry is not the same P as before. It's determined by the interaction energy in the Potts models. But that gets raised to the power of the number of open bonds, so the number of occupied bonds times 1 minus P to the total number of bonds minus the number, so that's the number of unoccupied bonds. And then you have Q to the power of the number of distinct clusters. Okay, that's the random bond representation of the Potts model. Now, why do we have to use this in the first place? Well, the reason is that it's hard to do conformal field theory directly in percolation, and this original analysis, this is following Carty's work from some years ago, I think it was 93 or something. Dean was not correcting me? Okay, must be right then. Identified some of the operators that we're going to need in a minute in the Potts model, and then assume that if you take the limit Q going to 1, you would be okay, which is now known rigorously to be true. So what you get here is exactly the same configurations that you get in bond percolation, but they're weighted differently if Q is not equal to 1, say for the Ising model, Q is 2 and so on. Okay, now, if you look at just the partition function of Q equals 1, it's just a constant. You can take it to be 1, it doesn't matter. But there's non-trivial information in the correlation function and also actually in derivatives of things like partition functions with respect to Q. And if you look at a large but finite lattice, Z will be a polynomial in Q, so you can extend the definition to non-integer values, and it makes sense to think about the limit Q going to 1. Although, of course, being physicists, we don't always worry about that kind of thing. But anyway, how does that relate to crossing probabilities? Well, the key idea, as already sort of you may have heard from some of the remarks, is to consider boundary conditions. Okay? So I want to look at a Potts model on a rectangle, and I'm going to take Q going to 1 to get percolation, with the spins on one boundary specified to be all in one state, say Q equals A on the left, and Q equals B on the right, and then free, that is unconstrained, on the top and the bottom. And so you'll have this diagram. So there are two cases, either the fixed spins on the left and the right are in the same state, or the fixed spins on the left and the right are in different states. Okay, and they'll have two different partition functions, call them ZAA and ZAB. Now, every configuration that you can put in here, either has a crossing or doesn't. Here's one that doesn't have a crossing, so that'll contribute to both partition functions, right? Because where it touches here, this has to be in state B and that has to be in state A, but that's fine because they don't connect with each other. And if you have one which does cross, it can contribute on the left, okay, because all the spins will be in the same state, A, but it doesn't contribute on the right. Okay? And so this guy includes everything, and that includes everything except the clusters which cross from left to right. And so you have, by this beautiful argument due to John Carty, the result that the horizontal crossing probability is the limit as Q goes to one of the difference of those two partition functions. Okay. And so that's what you use to extrapolate down to the percolation limit from the POTS models. And so now the problem is to calculate these partition functions. And that can be done using correlations of boundary operators in conformal field theory, as I'll describe shortly. Okay, now just to remind you, the clusters that I drew, of course, are extremely schematic. In a real system, the clusters at criticality are very ramified. Here's a single cluster at the percolation point on a actually on a square lattice, I believe. That's just one cluster. There'll be others, too. They're fractal objects, in fact, as probably most people know. Okay, now the next brief review. You're going to be bombarded with brief reviews here, I'm afraid, but it's conformal field theory, which I'll just mention some of the main points of. It's obviously a very big topic, but one of the main elements is the transformation of correlation functions, and particularly of objects which are called primary operators. These operators, well, first of all, in the general case, they're a function of two complex variables, z and z bar, which you take to be independent. And then if you make an arbitrary conformal mapping from one, let's say from z to w of z, then you have to multiply by the derivative of that to the power of h, or h bar, depending on z, whether you're using z or z bar. These are the conformal weights. Generally, they're both real of the operator, say phi I at z and z bar. And of course, the original work on this was done, it's now, 23 years ago, I guess, by Balav and Polyakov and Zamolodnikov. This is one of the main ingredients, not the only one. Now, it's interesting, although whether this really means anything, I make no representation, but if you just look at the behavior of one variable, it transforms like that. Okay? I'm leaving it just to simplify the equation. That equation has exactly the same form as the condition satisfied by modular forms. The difference is, of course, that here the WZ is any conformal map, and there it's much more restricted than there are other conditions on modular forms. But still, it's kind of intriguing, I always thought. I've never done a thing with it, but anyway, there it is. However, to get back to our story, remember, we wanted to calculate these partition functions with particular boundary conditions. Okay, and let's look at the ZAB.
Just a linear function?
No, the W is an arbitrary conformal map. In modular forms, it's a linear, particular linear, Möbius transformation with integer coefficients, and that's it. But here, no, here it's an arbitrary conformal map. So any analytic function in this case. So in particular, the ZAB partition function is the free partition function, which is a trivial constant, times an expectation value of boundary conformal operators. You notice these only depend on one variable. That's because they live in the half plane. So it's a little bit simpler in that sense. And what they do is implement a change of boundaries. So what we want to do is change from free to A and then from A to free and so on in order to get the right boundary conditions going around the rectangle. And the points z1 through z4 are the corners of the rectangle. Okay, so you have to figure out. So the problem this poses is, what are these operators? You have to identify the operators, and then you have to calculate the correlation function. Now, at the time this was done, It was known that the operator phi AB, which switches you from one fixed spin state on the boundary to another one, is phi 1,3. That was identified for the Ising model and the Potts model, but the identification has, of course, not been made in percolation. And that's not quite what you want. You want phi AF. You want to switch from fixed to free. But you can do that by using another important tool from CFT, which is the operator product expansion. And just roughly, I mean, the idea of this, roughly speaking, is that in at least rational conformal field theory, you have some discrete set of operators with long-range correlations. And so if you multiply two of them together when they're nearby, you've got to get a linear combination of those operators. And then you can say things about the coefficients from the conformal invariance. And so schematically, you have an equation like that. If you multiply AF by FB and bring the two points together, you could get a unit operator if the two fixed states are the same, plus a operator that changes u from A to B. That has to be what happens. And however, what happens is that you can work out these equations more explicitly, which allows you to identify phi AF. Now, if you don't know CFT, this doesn't really tell you much. But the point is here that you know what phi 1,2 is. You know its properties. And that's what you can take advantage of. And this conclusion, of course, is strongly supported by the fact that the dimension of this operator for q equals 1 is 0. Okay, and that will make the crossing probability scale invariant, a function only of the aspect ratio, not of the not of any length. That's in agreement with the numerical simulations, and of course, more recently there's a rigorous proof of this crossing formula, at least for one kind of lattice, by Smirnov. So what's the upshot? You have to calculate this particular four-point correlation function of 4, 5, 1, 2 operators. Okay, and this is, by the way, percolation corresponds to central charge C equals 0 if you're one of the CFT people. It turns out that that's not particularly difficult. John always knows how to pick the problems that are not only interesting, but not too hard, I think. But anyway, or at least it seems that way. Maybe that's not true. That's a little unfair. Sorry, I take that back. Just the first part is interesting and get good results. Okay, now, generally, if you had just an arbitrary four-point function, it would have you could write it in this way. There are powers of the coordinate differences depending on the power depends on the conformal weights of the operators that appear times the function of the cross ratio of the four points. But here all the h's are zero, so you only have f of lambda left over. And more importantly, for this phi 1,2 operator, it's just a second order differential equation that quantity satisfies, so it's relatively easy to solve. Okay. And conventionally, you know, things are conformally invariant here. So you can solve them in the upper half plane. You don't have to do it in a rectangle. Just map the corners of the rectangle to 0, lambda, 1, and infinity. And then you have crossing between those two intervals. And that crossing probability has to go to 0 as lambda goes to 0, because that corresponds to a long, thin rectangle. So the probability of crossing is 0. On the other hand, if the rectangle gets down to width 0, the probability is 1. There's always a crossing. So you've got the normalization. That will then normalize your solution for you. And the differential equation you get has two solutions. One's a constant, the other one's a hypergeometric function. And you can, by applying these boundary conditions, then get Cardy's formula for the crossing on the rectangle. There it is. It's lambda to the, there's a constant, times lambda to the 1/3. That's the cross ratio again, I'll get to that in a second. It's lambda to the 1/3 times this particular hypergeometric function of lambda. Now, two things. First of all, the left-hand side is a function of r, the right-hand side is a function of lambda. Remember, r is the aspect ratio of the rectangle, and lambda is the cross ratio. You have to express one in terms of the other, which is not particularly hard to do, and we'll get to that shortly. But that's a definite function. The other thing is, you notice it's lambda to the 1/3. Okay, there's a first hint of triangular symmetry, and we'll see this again as I continue. It's also that 1/3 is also the conformal weight of this phi AB operator that I mentioned before, the one that changes you from one fixed state to another at percolation. Now, this isn't any old hypergeometric function that comes in. It's a special one. it satisfies C minus A equals 1, which means you can write it as a single interval of an algebraic function like that. Okay. And that reflects the fact that the hypergeometric equation that is satisfied by F can be factored this way. So you see one solution is constant, and that's the other one. Now, if you look at that integral, it's interesting, that was around for years, and nobody realized until Carlson some time ago that that is a Schwarz-Christoffel transformation. And in fact, it's a Schwarz-Christoffel mapping from the half plane to an equilateral triangle. And so if you map yourself onto an equilateral triangle with side length 1, Cardan's formula just becomes that. The probability of crossing from one side to a length x of another one is exactly x. Okay. Which is really, I mean, that's really beautiful, I think. And here again, you see the triangular symmetry, right? And remember, this holds regardless of the symmetry of the lattice. It can be a square lattice, triangular, hexagonal, whatever. It's a universal result.
Do you know whether Smirnov thought about it this way, or whether his triangle came out of some completely independent?
Well, there's probably a relation, but the idea is that it's easier to prove on a triangular lattice, right, probably because of the triangular symmetry. Right. But I don't think he was. But maybe you know. Yeah, they did. Oh, that's right. Of course, yeah. Yeah. I mean, maybe that got him. It may have inspired him. I don't know. But
the hypergeometric constant equation, is its monodromy group a modular group?
I just don't know offhand. Yeah, that I wouldn't know. And just a small remark. I mean, what happens to the conformal weight one third here? You remember you had lambda to the one third times a function of lambda. That's become the angle of the triangle, pi over 3. That's where it's gone. But that just sort of... Okay, now what about... So all of that was for the horizontal crossing probability, the probability of finding a configuration that connects one end of the rectangle to the other end. What about the horizontal vertical one? So that's the probability of connecting all four sides. There was a similar analysis that was carried out by Watts. I won't go through the details. Just give you the result, which is a fifth-order differential equation. Oh joy, right? Which it turns out you can factorize. Actually, you can factorize it in three different ways. But here's one way. And if you factorize it that way, then if you set the rightmost factor equal to 0, you have a solution set which is a constant: the horizontal crossing probability and the horizontal vertical crossing probability. You can get all three things out of it. You can actually get, if you look at the other solutions, you can also get out of this, as Meyer pointed out a little while ago, the expected number of horizontally crossing clusters, a formula which, again, Cardy worked out some years ago. But I'm not going to go into that today.
Is that Fuchsin? Is it Fuchsin?
I think so, yeah. Now, it's convenient to define the probability of a horizontal crossing with no vertical crossing. H, that should be bar V. I wrote underline just because I was, well, anyway, doesn't matter. Sometimes I write it out. Yeah, here I write it over. It's the same thing. So that's pi H minus pi HV. That, again, has a very simple form. You can write it in terms of a generalized hypergeometric function, a 3F2, or as a, in this case, double integral of algebraic integrands. And it's that function, or really its derivative, which becomes this higher-order modular form, this new modular object, as I'll get to at the end if there's time. And I should mention that there's a rigorous proof of this formula now from SLE by Dubida.
Peter, is there a conformal correlator known that gives rise to this function?
Well,
relation and Q equals 1.
I'll talk to you later. That's I mean, it comes from the... it comes from the higher order null vector in the H equals 0, C equals 0 module. I mean, that's where he got it. But,
When you say higher order, you just mean higher weight?
No, it's this complicated structure. It's an embedding structure of null vectors, and it comes out of that. Okay, so now on to what we originally called anchored percolation clusters or connection probabilities. So this is the recent work that I did with Jake Simmons and Bob Ziff. Let's consider a cluster in the upper half plane that has to touch the real axis, let's say, at one point. And if you measure the density of such clusters, then it'll look like this, and that's either this picture, so here's where it's touching, and the density drops off as you move away in some smooth way. That picture, both the prediction and the numerical simulation agree very, very well for that, as you might expect. What do they mean? It's just some, this is from Bob Ziff, so I don't know exactly, but it's just some convention for dropping of it. It's falling off smoothly.
It's falling off.
Yeah, it's falling off. It's not repeating. Yeah. Absolutely. So how do you solve this? Well, more conformal magic, which I probably shouldn't use. But the idea is very simple. If you want, let's see. So if you have a free boundary condition and a fixed one over here, then that's implemented by a phi 1, 2 operator. And if you bring two of them close together, like that, okay, so you have one phi 1, 2 over here, and another phi 1, 2 over here, then you'll get from the operator product expansion, again, the unit operator plus this phi 1, 3, which is the phi AB operator that I had before. And clearly what's going on is the unit operator corresponds to just having a free boundary condition to nothing, and this corresponds to a free boundary condition with a little bump on it where a single cluster can be anchored. Okay. And it's easy to, you know, pick out the solutions. So you just put in a phi 1, 3 here, and then you want to measure the density. How do you do that? Well, that's done with the spin operator, psi, which is unfortunately a half. It's a phi 3 half 3 half, which is an operator that you know exists, but you don't know much more about it besides it's having a conformal dimension. In any case, that measures the density, the cluster density. And since you're in the upper half plane, you have to have an image of that operator to preserve the boundary. Okay, so you get phi z, psi z, psi z bar.
How do you get this? How do you know that this is the operator you need?
Which one?
Well, how do you identify this operator?
It's the spin operator. The spin operator measures the density of the. But that's all. Yeah. And so that's a three-point function in the full plane, which is known. The conformal form for that is very simple, and so you can just write it down up to a constant, which I didn't write in here. There's a multiplicative constant, which is non-universal, that then multiplies the right-hand side. But it has this form as a function. Let's see, if you anchor the cluster at x and look at point z, which is distance r away, and a distance y above the axis, it has that form. It's also kind of interesting that you can write this one-point density in terms of the potential of a two-dimensional dipole that's pointing upright sitting on the axis at x. It's just a simple 2D electrostatic potential to the power 1/3 and then divided by some power of y. Y to the 548. Okay. And that agrees, you know, very, very well with numerical simulations. Now, you can also ask for the problem of the density of a cluster which is anchored at two points on the real axis. So points x1 and x2 that are separated by a distance d. I'm going to give up with this thing. The trees are too small out here. Okay, separated by distance c. That'll have now two operators that create a cluster, and then you need the psi and psi bar to measure the density up in the half plane. Now, because of these phi one threes, and because this is a four-point function, you have to solve a differential equation. What happened to you?
Why don't you take the smaller one?
The other one.
Another one, which is better.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, this one.
Better if you point in the right direction. So you now have the phi 1 3 operator, which satisfies a third-order differential equation, has a level 3 null vector. And if you look at the asymptotic, so then I'm going to have three solutions, right? And you have to figure out what to do with them. Now the operator product expansion of two phi 1 3s. Is unit operator plus phi 1 3 plus phi 1 5. The unit operator, you know, is clearly not what you want. That doesn't give you the structure that has to be there. And the phi 1 5 has been identified as an operator which gives you two clusters separated by a dual line in percolation. And so you can get rid of that. So you just, you're left with one solution.
Sorry, when you talk about all this fusion, like, you know that these are exactly the same CAD stable operators? Like you can think of fusing 513, getting just...
Yeah, they are. That's just CAD stable fusion. It's nothing special.
Yeah, so it's valid for arbitrary Q in the POTS model.
Right.
So you can vary Q continuously.
So you can just think of it as normal CAD stable.
We're outside the unitary box. I forgot to mention that. So percolation is non-unitary.
So this interpretation terms of a Solis, and then we don't care about the unitaries.
Ways
of connecting the Solis lines, which start from there. So
unitarity is not, it doesn't have to be, it's not always a symmetry in statistical theories, and not certainly not in percolation. So anyway, you get a solution like this, which factorizes. It's the square root of the product of two one-point densities. So these are clusters anchored at the points x1 and x2, divided by d to the one-third. But on the other hand, if you think about it, the density of a cluster at a point z attached to a point x is just proportional to the probability of a connection from x to z, or really a crossing, if you want, from a small region around x to a small region around z. Okay. And 1 over d to the one-third is the square root, up to a constant, of the probability of a crossing between the two points x1 and x2. You can get that right out of Cardy's formula. And so this whole thing can be rewritten as the probability of a connection between these three points, two on the axis and one in the half plane, is equal to the square root of the product of the probabilities of the two-point crossings times a constant c. Okay. But now, this is universal. Okay, if you take z down to the axis, you can see that c is just a boundary operator product expansion coefficient. Okay. So not only is that exact, but it's universal. All the non-universal constants go away in that equation. And in fact, you can calculate this OPE coefficient c. It has that interesting looking form. There's lots of ways to write it, but anyway, it's lots of nice rational powers of odd looking functions, and it's 1.02992, blah, blah, blah. I won't give any details on that, just say that it's a standard OPE calculation. You use essentially crossing symmetry to calculate this. Nothing special about it. We also tested this extensively. Actually, we did the computer simulations first to find C, but by computer simulation, you find C is 1.031 plus or minus 001, so it's an excellent agreement with that. And here's a picture of what the computer simulations give you, thanks to Bob Ziff. Here are simulations of the density of clusters anchored at this point or that point. On the left-hand side, this is in a square, but the equation holds also in a square. You can transform it. And here is, remember which is which, I think this is the density of the clusters that are anchored at both points. Okay. And over here, you have the square root of that product of the three probabilities multiplied by this numerical constant c, and you can see these things are practically identical. Okay. They're very, very close to each other. But what's interesting, it's not only a check, this numerical work, you can also see that the formula holds asymptotically when one or both of these points on the axis move off. So the point where the cluster was anchored on the axis, you can take it off the axis, and you still get this result asymptotically. Okay. Which means that there are additional terms in the CFT expansion. And we're working to try to derive that, and we might be able to do it. Well, we'll see. Got some ideas on doing that, but it's not done yet. Okay, so now I want to go to the last part, but longest one, talking about the connection between these crossing probabilities of percolation and also SLEs and modular forms. So this is the work I did with Anzaghier. So I've been spending a lot of time in recent years around number theorists, not only on this project, but other ones too. And after a while, you get a sort of picture of what they're like, which is different. I mean, it's just not the same. And so I came up with kind of a working definition from a physicist's point of view. It's someone who's willing to spend an infinite amount of time on an impossible problem. There's a sous-entendu under that, which doesn't actually get somewhere with it. And I always leave a lot of space for the number theorists fulfill in their definition of a physicist, but I haven't heard one yet. Or maybe they don't want to tell me, I don't know. But.
You need to characterize number series?
I'm sorry?
You need to characterize number series?
It's a tendency, I think. I don't know all number theorists. So let's just remind ourselves of the two crossing formulas. You had this horizontal crossing formula, which here I've written in terms of a hypergeometric function. And remember, R is the aspect ratio of the rectangle, lambda is the cross ratio of the four points that map to the corners of the rectangle from the real axis. And then there's the horizontal but not vertical crossing, which here I've written as a double integral, again, as a function of lambda. So as I mentioned before, in order to make progress, now you have to write this cross ratio lambda in terms of the aspect ratio R. And it's traditional to let tau be IR, and then lambda is a function of tau. It's actually already a modular function or Hauptmodule for some subgroup. That's not particularly important for us, but it is. And you can write it in many different ways. One way to write it is as a ratio of powers of Dedekind eta functions. Okay. And again, this Dedekind eta function itself is a modular form of weight 1/2. If that doesn't mean anything right now, never mind. It's not really important. It's just a remark. And then it's traditional to divide Q as e to the 2 pi I tau. But if you let R go to infinity, or lambda go to zero, you'll notice that lambda, you can see from this, that lambda goes like the square root of Q, okay, which I'll call Q hat. And that's no accident. That Q hat comes in because we're doing CFT on a rectangle. And we'll see it again, because we're not on a torus. Which, of course, is, in a way, the whole, a big piece of the interest in this is that you've got modular properties for a problem which is defined on a rectangle of geometry with edges, not a torus. If you were on a torus, you would expect it and you'd get it. You do get it, it's known. But on a rectangle, you don't expect anything, but in fact, it happens. So it's convenient to look, as I already kind of indicated before, at the R derivative, the derivative with respect to aspect ratio of these two quantities. Let's call them F1 and F2. It was already noticed some years ago by Bob Ziff that the in F1, the R derivative of the horizontal probability is eta to the fourth. And if I remember right, I think it was that kind of got me thinking about this whole business. And in fact, the story involves looking around for a number theorist who knew about these things, and finally somebody said Zagier likes it, and I sent him a few questions in an email, and 2 days later I came back with a 3-page answer, but anyway. I can tell you that story later if you want to hear it. And then F2, the derivative of the horizontal but not vertical crossing can be written that way. This F1 is actually a modular form already, weight 2, and you'll see what that means in a minute, but F2 is something new. Okay, so here comes your next crash course. Having mastered CFT, you can now move on to modular forms. These are holomorphic functions of tau in the upper half plane that have certain transformation properties under, as I'll define it here, the full modular group. And that full modular group is the subset of Möbius transformations, which are A tau plus B over C tau plus D, but with coefficients that are integers. And AD minus BC has to be 1. So this is a subset of conformal mappings, as I mentioned. Now, the most important defining property is this one. If you take the function on the transformed element tau, it's equal to C tau plus D to the power K times the function of tau, okay. Where K is now, I guess I didn't write that here, did I? K is, oh, I said it. K is the weight of the modular form. And generally, that's an integer or a half integer. And it has to be positive, too, zero or positive. Now, just again, to remind you of that remark that I made a long time ago already about how this connects to the conformal transformation, if you write it this way, you can see it's the same form equation. It's as if it had a conformal weight k over 2. Of course, it's not the same set of transformations, but still. Okay, now, this modular group can be generated by two operations, tau going to tau plus 1 and tau going to minus 1 over tau. This S, by the way, if you ever read this literature, some people use T and S this way, some people reverse them. And there's all kinds of arguments as to which way is better. But anyway, that's what happens. The tau going to minus 1 over 10, that's r going to 1 over r, okay, which we already looked. This is something we haven't really talked about yet. But you can implement these guys with the two matrices here, 1, 1, 0, 1, and 0, minus 1, 1, 0. And so instead of the general equation that I wrote for f before, you can implement it with just these two equations, f of tau plus 1 is f of tau, and f of minus 1 over tau is tau to the k times f of tau. There's no k that appears here because the derivative is 1. Okay. Actually, it's not quite this simple. I'm going to put another factor in here in a minute. But that's basically it. Okay, so those are the conditions for modular form. Plus, there are some growth and infinity conditions as well. Okay, now we're almost ready for a theorem. Now, I am not deriving the crossing probabilities here. I'm characterizing them because I have to make certain assumptions. Okay, so this is not a derivation. It just shows that they fit into this modular framework. But F1, remember, is the R derivative of the horizontal crossing probability. That's eta to the fourth. Okay, it's a modular, eta to the fourth is a modular form of weight 2. It satisfies these equations. Here you see the weight 2. Right, tau squared. And if you take tau going to tau plus 1, you get an e to the pi I over 3. So I cheated a little bit in my defining equation. You're allowed to put in a factor here which has modulus 1. And when that's there, you say that the form has character. But that fits into the theory quite well, too. And the first theorem now will show that this function, this derivative of the horizontal crossing probability, in fact, the whole thing is completely characterized by some very simple assumptions and a modular argument. Just before I do that, I want to define any function on the real axis, the positive real axis, which is a power of q hat. Remember, that's the square root of q, so it's e to the minus pi r for us, times the power series in q hat. I want to call that a conformal block of dimension alpha. And you assume these ans are real. Now, if you only have even ans, you call it an even conformal block. And the function, the derivative of pi h has this, is an even conformal block. But notice this is the definition. I'm just calling it a conformal block. It doesn't necessarily have anything to do with conformal field theory at this point, because this is the kind of function that comes up. Okay, now finally, you can write down the first theorem. Yeah. So let's let pi be any function on the positive real axis, which is an even conformal block and has a positive dimension and satisfies this duality condition. This is the duality condition from way back at the beginning. Pi of 1 over r is 1 minus pi of r. Okay. Then it follows, the only those two things are necessary, that alpha is 1/3 and pi of r is Cardy's function. Okay. So it completely characterizes the horizontal crossing probability with just these two assumptions. Okay, how do you prove that? Well, this proof is pretty simple, so let's just go through it. I think we have enough time for that. It's not really complicated. Okay, so you analytically continue, and now I'm going to use this slash notation, which drives all physicists nuts, and some number theorists too, but it's just the action of a matrix with a given weight and a function, because it's backwards and so on, but anyway. F2 acting by S is minus F, and by T it's e to the pi I alpha F, because it's a conformal block of dimension alpha. On the other hand, if you act on by STQ...
What's this thing with 2?
That's the thing which drives all physicists nuts. It means F, the function F, acted on by the matrix S with weight 2.
What is the weight of the matrix or weight of the...
No, it's weight of the modular form, in the modular form equation. So you have to take C tau plus D to the minus 2. Okay. Multiply by that. Back to the original.
You transform the argument to the matrix, and you also multiply it by this.
All right. Nope, it wasn't too far back. I don't remember where it was. That's the one before. Yeah, here we go. Okay. So you have to multiply by that. That's with the 2 in that case. Okay. It's the C top plus D to the power 2 here.
So let me understand. So you move this thing on the left, and
yeah,
the left hand side,
yeah,
you call F vertical.
F vertical sub 2. Yeah, so K, yeah, and then S in this case, or gamma, and more generally, right? Yep. Okay. On the other hand, then you act by ST cubed. The reason for that is that ST cubed is 1, okay, and you can see you're going to get minus e to the 3 pi I alpha. So 3 alpha has to be an odd integer, and therefore f to the six, f to the six will just get one times f here when you act on it by S or T.
When you say that, you're not assuming that f is a modular form of
two.
You're transforming it like.
I'm using only these assumptions. That's it. This is strictly
so
true.
So in the first case, you're transforming it as log of weight 2. In the second case, T is log of weight 1.
No, T doesn't, the weight doesn't come into T. T doesn't affect, the K does, is independent.
Ah, okay.
I mean, there's no K part in this equation because it just pulls out a factor of modulus unity at most. So 3 alpha has to be an odd integer. So f to the 6 is a form of weight 12 on gamma 1 is actually a cusp form, which means it, in this case, it vanishes at infinity because alpha is positive. And there's a standard result in modular form that's a one-dimensional space spanned by 8 to the 24th, so that's it. So, pardon?
Discriminant.
Yeah.
So where is the important information in the hypothesis of this term?
Well, also that there's only one conformal block, okay? I didn't actually say that. There's only a single even conformal block, if you want to emphasize it. Because if you take two conformal blocks, there doesn't seem to be anything you can do. So there's something special about that, too. And the alpha greater than 0 is physically motivated, because if you want pi to be a probability, it has to vanish at r goes to infinity. Negative alpha would blow up. So that's quite reasonable to assume, if you have that in mind, for your result. Okay, so as I said, why should this work? We don't really know. Now the S transformation is just coming from duality, but the T comes from the CFT analysis and the fact that you have a single conformal block. And I don't know any simple physical reason for that, but if you can find one, you might be able to get a nice new proof of these relations. Okay, now the next theorem applies to SLEs, so I have to say a little bit about SLEs. And I see I don't really have a lot of... we're going to get kicked out at 12:30, right?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, well, I'll try to go quickly. So this is, as some of you have seen this, and I think some of you probably not. Some of you know this way better than I do, so please excuse the rough introduction. But it's a theory of stochastic conformal maps that are driven by a Brownian process of speed kappa. Okay. And what you do is color the real axis, Brownian, the conformal maps on the upper half plane. You color the real axis black for x less than 0 and white for x greater than 0, and you start a path at 0, and it moves around randomly, that path. And that, roughly speaking, it separates the parts that connect to the black boundary from the ones connected to the white boundary. That path is called a trace, so here it is starting at 0. Various things can happen in this. This is all in the continuum limit. It's obviously a continuum theory from the beginning, but it includes models. It includes percolation among the models. And of course, not all of the cases are, well, it's a mathematical theory, and there's not an identification for every kappa by any means with statistical models. Okay, so the path can look like that. In percolation, it can't cross, but in the continuum limit, it can touch. Whoops. And here's a diagram, shamelessly cribbed from the paper by Ilya and Leo Kadanoff.
No,
it's a nice diagram.
No.
Yeah.
Bernard and Bauer.
Oh, that's Bernard and Bauer. Oh, I'm sorry. Oh my God. Okay. I can't keep track of my own sins. I don't know what. It must be getting old. Yeah.
You should also write the names. It was Lohler.
Yeah. Wrong names. Yeah.
Did I write? Oh, I'm sorry. Did I get the names wrong? Oh my God. All right, well, I'll fix that. Oh my God, Werner, I'm sorry.
Lohler.
Sorry. Lohler and Werner, excuse me. So I better write that. That's embarrassing. I hadn't seen that. Oh, thank you. So it's Schramm. That, I think, was right. Wendell and Werner. And it's he who won the Fields Medal this year, and Lohler, who originated this whole idea, which is a very interesting development, as you probably all know, because it's started with mathematicians, not physicists. The path that you get depends on the speed of the Brownian process. Basically, it depends how fast you wiggle the point back and forth as it moves off the real axis. If it's not too fast, you get a simple path, and that means kappa less than 4. Okay, if it's between 4 and 8, you get a path which touches itself but never crosses. Okay. And then if it's bigger than 8, it fills up all space after a while. And what we're going to see is that these two limits, 4 and 8, arise from some modular considerations too. Now what you actually do in SLE, the union of this region inside the path and the path itself is called the, what did I say? Oh, it's called the hull, there it is. Okay, the hull KT. And what you do is write an equation for the conformal regularizing map that takes that hull and smooshes it out. Okay, so it takes the region above the hull and maps that into the upper half plane. Okay, so you're always regularizing in that way. And here's the differential equation that you get. Okay, it's the time derivative of GT is 2 over GT minus root kappa times the Brownian Brownian component. So this is going to give you a stochastic differential equation. Now, what we're interested in is crossing probability, and that's a little bit subtle. And this diagram I do remember is from Carty's review paper. Whether or not there's a crossing, say, between x1 and minus infinity and 0 and x2 depends on whether you swallow x1 first or swallow x2 first. Okay, because the path, when you're between kappa and 2, the path will always hit the real axis. You know, almost always in it. So here you get a crossing on white disks if and only if x1 is swallowed first. Okay? So that's what you have to calculate. And it turns out you can calculate that using Ito's equation. And what you get, which is the important point for us, is a generalization of Carty's formula, valid for kappa greater than 4. For kappa less than 4, I think you just never get a crossing, right? It never touches the real axis. And it has this form, again, it's a cross ratio to a power, which now depends on kappa, times a hypergeometric function whose parameters depend on kappa. This function satisfies the same duality. It's actually, the duality would be f of lambda plus f of 1 minus lambda is 1 in those variables. Same duality as Carty's formula. And if kappa equals 6, you get Carty's formula back, and that's because kappa equals 6 is percolation. Well, percolation is a model described by kappa equals 6. And again, the hypergeometric functions are simple. You can write them as a single integral of an algebraic integrand. But there's some problems even in paradise. This crossing probability on the rectangle is a single conformal block again, but it's not even. Okay, so now you get odd powers of square root of q. So either the pi or tau comes in. And that means you have to work with the theta group, which is generated by s and t squared. So now you let tau go to tau plus 2. Not tau plus 1. This is not as nice a group to work with, as you'll see. And in order to make some progress, to prove the next theorem, you need this kind of sum rule, which is satisfied by the zeros in modular form. You can actually prove the first theorem this way, too. But I gave you the other proof. And for gamma theta, this is the theorem. You get this theorem by integrating the logarithmic derivative of f around the boundary of the fundamental region of the group. Okay. So it turns out that the sum of zeros is k over 4. Read the right-hand side first. And here you have k is the weight of the modular form. And these nus are the order of the zeros at a given point.
Is it the same as gamma 2? Is gamma theta the same as?
No, I don't think so. No. It's not a lot is done with it for whatever reason. I don't know exactly why, but it hasn't been studied that much as far as I'm aware. So you get various zeros here, which kind of come in specially, the one at infinity. And then 1 and I are cusp points of the fundamental region, the fundamental region for the... actually, for the theta group, the fundamental region looks like this. So this is 1. I'm drawing it backwards. We could make it minus 1. It doesn't matter. Minus 1 and I. Usually it's thrown the other way. So you have one point that goes down to the real axis. And so these guys are weighted differently. Well, this one's weighted differently anyway. And then you might have zeros inside the fundamental region. You've got to add those. But the sum of all these things, and these are all have to be positive or 0, it has to be k over 4, so that's a pretty strong constraint. That's enough to get somewhere. Okay, so now the weight's going to be k equals 2. Let's see, I should show you why, I guess. So we're going to take now any function that's positive on the positive real axis, that's a conformal block. And now I need to make a technical assumption, the coefficients are polynomial growth. I'll get to that in a minute. But it satisfies this equation. So its derivative will have an S transformation which has weight 2. And so the right-hand side of that sum rule is a half. And by the polynomial growth assumption, these two zeros have to be, zeros have to be positive and real. On the other hand, the new I and new P have to be integers. Okay, so they just got to be zero, because if you put one integer on the left-hand side in, you're bigger than a half already. And so the only possibility, it turns out, is that nu infinity is alpha, and it's got to be positive, and then the other one is a half minus alpha. And so you discover that alpha's got to go between 0 and a half, like this. And the function pi 1 is the generalized crossing probability.
If you have a non-integer order of the 0, is it really a branch cut or
something? No, it's because it's at infinity. That's why. This one's on the real axis, and that's at infinity. That's on the
edge. So how can they be non-integer?
Well, because it can go like at infinity, it goes like e to the minus alpha r, or pi alpha r. That's what's going on there. Right. So they can be non-integers, but these ones inside can't. Those are the cusp points, actually, for this group. So where do these bounds come from? Because these bounds, as we'll see in a minute, these are the 4 and the 8. They're equivalent to kappa being between 4 and 8. Right? Where do they come from? Well, it's the assumption that this function is holomorphic. If you say that the coefficients are polynomial growth, that's equivalent to requiring that the function be holomorphic. And then for holomorphic at the cusp, that gives you then this kappa between 4 and 8. And what happens is, if kappa is less than 4, which I forget which alpha end of the alpha range it is, must be the 0 end. If it's less than, alpha is less than 0, then the whole thing just blows up. There's no probability crossing at all. If it's bigger than 8, then you still get a formula, but it won't be with coefficients of polynomial growth. So, but we don't really know how to interpret that otherwise. I mean, that's a mathematical thing. Okay, and finally, in these theorems, there's a last theorem, which is probably too horrible to contemplate, but the idea here is to generalize the horizontal vertical crossing probability. Okay, and so you assume that you have a pi 1 like in theorem 2. So this is the SLE. This gives you the SLE crossing. Okay. And then pi 2 is a second function, which again is a polynomial growth. Okay, so it's a conformal block of weight beta in this case, and that's generalizing the pi hv bar. So this is the pi h for SLEs, and this would be the generalization of pi hv bar. And with those assumptions, you can get a one parameter, or given alpha, you can get a one parameter family of solutions. Why is it this? There we go. Thank you. which is a rather messy looking, but it's quite explicit. Okay. The problem here is that for a given alpha, we don't know what beta is, except for percolation, where we already know the answer. Alpha is 1/3 and beta is 1. Okay. And if you further assume that these functions have to be positive because they're probabilities, and you can cut it down a little bit more, but you still have a range of allowed for a given alpha. Okay. So as I said, these functions are generalizing pi hv bar and pi hv, and so this theorem gives you a generalization of the horizontal crossing probabilities to SLEs, or maybe to the models that they represent. And there aren't any results for this, and in fact, Wendell and Werner told me a while ago that he didn't even know how to define horizontal vertical crossing, but on the other hand, his student Dubedat did manage to do it for the percolation case, but that proof does not extend to any other case. At any rate, the key assumption, the key element is the assumption 4, which was, which one was 4? Sorry. Yeah, this one with the arrow, right? That's the key element here, that this one of our, this S symmetry, rather. Okay, now I think maybe it's getting late unless somebody wants to see it. No, we got to get out of here anyway. I'll skip the proof of this. It's rather involved. Basically, you have to rearrange things in such a way that you can get down to an object which is a modular form. It's a rather, a complicated object. You take F2 over F1, these are derivatives of pi 1 and pi 2, and then you multiply by B prime, differentiate that and multiply by F1, and that thing, it turns out, is a modular form of weight 4 and gamma theta, and that gives you the answer, you know, modulo a lot of complications and calculations. Gives you the answer that I showed. Okay, and I already said that as to what it might mean physically. Okay, and finally, let's go way back to the beginning where we differentiated these two crossing probabilities and there was a difference of sign here, pi h and pi hv. So remember, pi h prime is f1 and pi h v bar, pi h v prime is, no, pi h v bar prime is f2. So you can rewrite that equation that way, okay? And now if you just subtract those two, you get an equation for F2. That's the pi hv bar prime, which is, when acted on by S, it's F2 minus 2 times F1. Okay, so when you act on it with a modular operator, you don't just get the function back, you get the function back plus a different modular form. And that's something new, apparently. I mean, I didn't know these things, but certainly no expert on modular forms, that could happen. And you also know that F2 satisfies T squared B F2. It was a single conformal block. And so that leads you to define a second order modular form as some holomorphic function which when acted on by a group element with weight k and then subtracting itself gives you another modular form of weight k for all elements in the group, okay, rather than being zero as it would for an ordinary modular form. And you can generalize that obviously to higher order modular forms. And there's been a lot of work on this recently. There's something like 7 papers that have come out in this area trying to understand how these higher order modular forms behave and so on. And so that's about it. I think I'll stop there. So here are the conclusions. Got some results from conformal field theory which given an exact and universal factorization of a certain connection probability in critical 2D percolation. And then hopefully I've convince you that modular forms are relevant for crossing probabilities in critical 2D percolation and SLEs, even though the symmetry isn't there, but you would expect them to mean something. And then a new kind of modular object arises, which is the higher order modular form. And here are some of the references for these things, if you want to look it up. Okay, thank you. Yeah.
You had one
transform on the possible physical interpretation of the Laplace time beta. Could you show it? Sure. Oops. Yeah, I think this is probably the one you mean, right? Yeah. So what that last long theorem shows you is that for each alpha, which is directly related to the speed kappa of the SLE, there's a possible horizontal or vertical crossing probability R of alpha and beta. The problem is that beta is only specified within a range. For these numbers, you get Watts's result, but that's nothing new. And the hope is that there, for a given value of alpha, you can find a beta that where this formula would mean something, would correspond to HV crossing in either an SLE or maybe some statistical mechanical model which it represents. Now, one remark we made, but this is purely mathematics, there's no physics behind this. If you set beta equal to 1, then the differential equation for pi HV bar is purely hypergeometric, okay, and for all alphas, which maybe means something, but I don't know. I mean, I don't know any way to argue that from the physics. Okay, so that's really all we can say at this point about whether or not these possible functions apply to some statistical model or not.
Okay, since it's already quite late, maybe we should defer.